Good evening, everyone. And Stephen, thank you very much for that welcome. It's a great pleasure to be back on this stage and an honour for me to be able to speak to so many of Australia's leading business economists. Before I turn to my main topic this evening, I'd like to pay tribute to one of my predecessors who passed away earlier this month, and that is, of course, John Phillips. John served the RBA for more than four decades, and between 1987 and 1992, he sat in the office that I now have the privilege of sitting in. John epitomised the first of the RBA's core values, that is, serving the public interest. He did this with great dedication over those four decades at the RBA, and he did it with great dedication in his highly distinguished subsequent career. At the RBA, John worked tirelessly to modernise Australia's financial and monetary system, and I'd have to say to modernise the RBA itself. The institution that I now serve, I think as well as the broader Australian community, owes him a considerable debt, and he will be sorely missed. Now, Stephen said, when I spoke at this dinner 2 years ago, the title of my remarks was, "What is Normal?" My thesis then was that as a country we were going through a difficult adjustment in expectations. Over the decade or so to the late 2000s, we'd got used to consumption growing more quickly than income. We'd got used to asset prices, credit, and fiscal revenues growing more quickly than income. We'd got used to employment increasing more quickly than the working age population. And we'd got used to growth in our real incomes outpacing the rate at which we were improving our productivity. And we started to think that this was normal. Retailers thought it was natural that their sales would grow more quickly than people's incomes. Many investors thought that the best way to create wealth was to just hold their existing assets and see the prices go up. Banks got used to very fast growth in their balance sheets, and we all got used to the annual tax cuts that came from strong revenue growth. But these trends were not normal, and so 2 years ago my thesis was that the dawning realisation of this was affecting the national psyche. 2 years on, I think we do better appreciate the uniqueness of this earlier period, and there has been some realignment in expectations. But I suspect this realignment is not yet over, and it is one of the things that continues to weigh on our national economic mood. Also weighing on that mood is the prospect of the so-called end of the resources boom. And as a result, I sense a degree of nervousness about our future amongst many commentators who ask questions like, what happens to Australia after the boom is over? How can Australian businesses compete internationally given our high costs? And where will the jobs of the future come from? These, of course, are all good questions. But if I return to another of the theme from 2 years ago, it's that uncertainty is normal. And I think given this, it is important that collectively we guard against the possibility that uncertainty mutates into chronic pessimism. That is, for it to become normal for us to think that our prospects are limited. And if this were to become our normal mindset, then we would be well on the way to finding ourselves in the very world that we feared. So this evening, I'd like to turn my eyes a bit to the future and talk a little about how the economy might look some way down the track. And my central thesis tonight is twofold. First, that the Australian economy does have the foundations for a successful and prosperous future. And second, how well we take advantage of those foundations depends increasingly not only on our investment in physical capital, but increasingly in human capital. So, if we look forward, what type of economy should we be aspiring to? Now, you could answer this question in many different ways, but I think a reasonable answer would be a highly productive, globally competitive economy that's operating close to or at full employment. Now, such an economy would be characterised by a national currency with sustainably high purchasing power. It would be characterised by sustainably high real wages, and it would be characterised by sustainably high real returns on capital. The high purchasing power and high wages mean that for each hour that we work, we're able to buy more goods and services, and the high returns means that savers get rewarded when they take a risk or they defer their spending and save for the future. Now, if we are to meet this aspiration, then we need to be an economy where value added is high. We need to be able to produce a range of goods and services very efficiently and or be able to sell those goods and services at a premium price because of their quality, their uniqueness, because of some other favourable characteristic. And this is true right across the industry spectrum. I'd say it's true in advanced manufacturing, in tourism, it's true in agriculture, it's true in the technology sector, and it's true in businesses and household services. In the end, I think it's very unlikely that we can achieve this aspiration by simply selling standardised, homogeneous, mass-produced goods and services on the world market. So we need to be at the high value-added end in much of what we do. And I think this is why investment in human capital is so important. It's through human capital that we can create the goods and services that can deliver on this aspiration. The quality of our human capital is critical to our ability to solve complex problems, to develop and use new technology, to develop premium goods and services that the world market wants, and to respond quickly and well to an ever-changing world. So one of the real challenges that I think lies ahead is to create the environment that encourages the investment in human capital that's ultimately required to sustain the high living standards and high returns to savers that we should be aspiring to. And I want to return to this challenge in a few moments. But before I do, it is important to recognise that the exchange rate, wages, and the returns to savings each also play an important role in how the economy is evolving at any particular point in time. In terms of the exchange rate, the RBA has been saying for quite a while now that a lower value of the Australian dollar would be helpful from an overall macroeconomic perspective. If the exchange rate is to play its important stabilising role, it needs to go down when the terms of trade and investment are declining, just as it went up when the terms of trade and investment were rising. And to date, and broadly as we expected, we have seen some adjustment in the currency, but if our assessment of the fundamentals is correct, we'd expect to see more over time. In terms of wages, there's sometimes commentary bemoaning their high level in Australia, and there's no doubt certain areas where wages are very high and working conditions are highly favourable, and some adjustment is likely to be required. But I think it is also useful to recall that over the past two decades, aggregate wage outcomes have been consistent with the inflation target and with a trend decline in unemployment, and they've also been associated with a fairly low share of wages in national income. And so while we do need to pay close attention to overall labour costs, I think these observations point to the conclusion that concerns about the overall level of wages in Australia are, at least to some extent, really concerns about the exchange rate, with the high exchange rate leading to high wages expressed in foreign currency terms. And so obviously a lower exchange rate would make a difference to these international wage comparisons. In terms of the return to saving, as you know, it's currently very low. As I spoke about in a talk last month, this largely reflects global factors. A lack of investment around the world relative to people's desire to save means that savers everywhere are being offered very low returns on their bank accounts. And this is causing them to look elsewhere, which is in turn pushing up the price of existing assets. And so from a cyclical perspective, and largely a result of global factors, our exchange rate's unusually high, and at the same time, savers are being offered unusually low rates. Of course, Australia is not unique in this position, and this particular configuration of exchange rates and interest rates is causing complications for macroeconomic management here, as it is in a number of other countries. But as we deal with these complications, we should not lose sight of the longer-run challenge of building a highly productive, globally competitive economy. And in my opinion, we should have considerable confidence that we are able to do this. We certainly have a number of strong fundamentals, strong foundations that provide the basis for future growth. And the question really is, how can we use those fundamentals, those foundations, over the years ahead? Now, rather than go through the long list of strong foundations, I want to draw your attention to just three. And the first, which I think fits in with the theme of this afternoon's discussion, is our linkages with the fastest growing part of the world economy, namely Asia. And I'm sure you all know the facts about the trade relationship here. Exports to Asia are up by 30% over the past 5 years. Our three largest export destinations, China, Japan and South Korea, obviously all in Asia, and we've struck free trade agreements with each of them over the past year. But the aspect of the relationships I want to focus on tonight is the people-to-people relationship. And as I hope you can see, yes, the graph has come up, thank you. As you can see from this first graph, currently around 8% of the Australian population was born in East and Southeast Asia or India. When I was born in the 1960s, this number was less than 1%. And in comparison, today in the United States, only around 3.5% of the population was born in Asia, and in most European countries, the figure's below 2%. This second graph, if it can be brought up, hopefully shows the large numbers of students from Asia that are studying in Australia. Currently, there are around 150,000 Chinese student enrolments at Australian educational institutions, more than double the number a decade ago. And there are large numbers of students from India, South Korea, Malaysia, Thailand, Vietnam, Singapore. All up, there are more than 250,000 Asian students currently studying here. And in time, these students will add to the already vast network of our alumni across the region. And the strong people-to-people linkages can also be seen in the broader data on international short-term arrivals, which is shown here. At the moment, more than 250,000 citizens from Asia are travelling to Australia every month, with arrivals from China reaching nearly 80,000 a month. And as you can see from this chart, these figures have been growing very strongly. And there has, of course, been strong growth in the number of Australians travelling to Asia for both business and leisure. Taken together, this deep and growing people-to-people engagement, I think, is an increasingly important national asset. It helps us better understand the most dynamic part of the global economy, promotes goodwill, and I think it can help identify cross-border business opportunities. As some of the students studying here will hopefully become champions for our own country when they return home, and others will no doubt remain here, and they will use their knowledge and their relationships in their country of birth to build new and stronger business ventures between our countries. The second foundation that I'd want to briefly talk about is our strong overall population growth. Over the past decade, Australia has had almost the fastest rate of population growth in the OECD. And as you can see here, this trend is expected to continue for some time to come. If these forecasts are correct, our population will be roughly 17% higher in a decade than it is today. That's an extra 4 million people living on our shores. And of course, these people will require somewhere to live, they'll require somewhere to work, and they'll require somewhere to play. So this population growth helps underpin the creation of new opportunities for many businesses and for individuals. It means that people can plan with the knowledge that the overall size of the pie is getting bigger. And you contrast that to the situation in Japan, where over the next decade, the population is expected to decline by about as many people who currently live in Melbourne today. In Australia, over the next decade, we're likely to add roughly another Melbourne to our population. The third foundation that I want to point to is our considerable endowment of natural resources, both in terms of minerals and agricultural land. And one illustration of the recent benefit that Australia has gained from its minerals is the large rise in export revenue as a share of GDP, which you can see here. And with a large increase in LNG exports still to take place, it's possible that this ratio will increase even further, although obviously that will depend upon the prices that we're able to get for our exports. Now, not all this extra revenue has accrued to Australian residents because of the high levels of foreign ownership in the resources sector, but this increase in revenue has helped boost our average living standards. Notwithstanding the current focus on the decline in mining investment, we should not lose sight of the fact that this extra export revenue, which has been made possible by the investment in extra capacity, has made us better off, and it has created opportunities that we would not otherwise have had. Now, in terms of strong foundations, I could have also talked about our strong institutions, our capable public sector, our flexible economy, a strong financial sector, low levels of government debt, and generally healthy corporate balance sheets. Combined, these factors have helped deliver average living standards in Australia that are amongst the highest on the planet, and they have given us opportunities that are available to only a few other countries. So how then do we best take advantage of these opportunities? And of course, there's no single answer here. But I do find it difficult to escape the conclusion that investment in human capital is central to taking advantages of the opportunities that we've built for ourselves. If you look at where the jobs have been created in Australia over the past couple of decades, two trends stand out for me. The first, is evident from this chart, is the fact that the largest increase has been in jobs with higher level qualifications. That's the high line there. The second trend is that in terms of industries, the bulk of the new jobs have been in services, with over 3.5 million service industry jobs having been created since the early 1990s. These jobs are in health, education, retailing, personal services, finance, engineering, information technology, software design, telecommunications, and you know the list that goes on. In contrast, just over 500,000 jobs have been created in the so-called goods-producing industries, manufacturing, mining, construction and utilities. And given the first of these two trends, many of these jobs, both in services and in the goods-producing industries, have required higher levels of skill. It would seem, therefore, that our future is increasingly dependent upon high-level cognitive skills and our ability to understand and solve complex problems. It depends upon having people who are curious, who are able to grasp new opportunities and who are able to transform and interpret information in new ways. It depends on having interpersonal skills to provide the premium services that will attract the premium price. Business practices everywhere are being reshaped and disrupted by developments in information technology, and this is not just true in the service industries but also in manufacturing, with much of today's innovative capital equipment as dependent on the software that runs it as it is on the quality and the ingenuity of the physical engineering. Now, how best to take advantage of this new world is not really the core expertise of the central bank, at least not this one. But I do want to make three observations. The first is the importance of culture. The type of human capital that's likely to be required in this world is best developed in a culture that promotes and rewards innovation and excellence, and that's whether it's in services, goods, resources, or agriculture. It's best developed in a culture that encourages entrepreneurship and that for people to take a risk with a new idea. And it's best developed in a culture that promotes creativity and flexibility. Now, developing and sustaining such a culture takes efforts across a huge range of areas. And so if we are to hope to make the best of the opportunities, then I think we should all be asking what we can do here to shape that culture. The second observation is the importance of ensuring that our workforce has the appropriate mix of sophisticated skills to produce premium goods and services. These skills are those required to solve complex problems, identify new opportunities, and deliver high-quality customer experiences. So creativity in all its dimensions is a key element here. Now, one of the areas that deserves close attention is the STEM subjects: science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And over the years, Australia has done reasonably well here, but I think as you can see from this chart, the share of Year 12 students studying high-level mathematics and the sciences has been in decline for many years now. I might also add that in our schools, considerably more young men study many of these subjects than do young women. And unfortunately, this is also true for the study of economics. In terms of the international tests, our PISA scores have been relatively high. If you can bring up the next chart, that's great. Thank you. Although they too have tended to slip a bit over recent years. And if we look beyond the STEM skills, we obviously need to create an environment that rewards creativity, innovation, and flexibility in our workforce. And the third and final observation is the need to find ways of deepening collaboration between our universities and businesses. Australia really has some tremendous places of higher learning. But as a number of reports have recently highlighted, the collaborative research connections between those universities and private business are not well developed here compared to the situation in many other countries. And according to many entrepreneurs that I've spoken to, it's the strong collaboration and networking that are critical elements in the development of the type of innovation ecosystems which new ideas can best flourish and be commercialised. I think this is an area that we need to pay close attention to. So let me try and conclude by bringing this all together. I suspect I've tried your patience by straying a long way from the setting of the cash rate, which I know is of keen interest to many of you. But in a very real sense, the issues that I've spoken about tonight do have profound implications for monetary policy. Now, the reason that the world has such low interest rates at the moment is that people's desire to save outstrips their desire to create new assets. A stronger global investment environment would be likely to see global interest rates rise, and this is something we should all hope occurs sooner rather than later. The issue that many countries are struggling with is how to do this, how to improve the investment climate. Now, very accommodative monetary policy is playing a role here, but there are some very real limitations to this, and in some countries these limitations are becoming increasingly evident. What is needed is a genuine improvement in the underlying investment climate. And so I think this is where the issues that I've spoken about tonight really do come in. The Australian economy clearly has some challenges ahead, and we've talked about those on previous occasions. But we would be selling ourselves short if we dwelt exclusively on those challenges. Our economy does have some very strong foundations upon which we can build, and I've talked about our links with Asia, our dynamic population, and our natural resources, and I could have gone on about other issues as well. These foundations give us opportunities that very few other countries have. They should provide us with some confidence that new investment can deliver reasonable returns in this country. In my view, this sense of confidence would be enhanced by further steps to improve the environment for the accumulation of human capital. And if we are to do this, then I hope it would become normal for us to live in a highly productive, globally competitive economy with sustainably high living standards and sustainably high returns to savers. So thank you very much for your patience. Thank you for listening. And I look forward to any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Phil, for those insights and I think also your sense of optimism. And now, as I mentioned earlier, a chance to ask a question. There's a microphone both front sides. If you can approach the microphone and state your name and affiliation and try and keep the questions short and to the point, and we'll get to get through as many as possible. So who would like to volunteer to go first? Here we go. Thanks.
Oh, hi, my name's Tim Perich from State Street. Just in regards to some of the things you said, is the RBA concerned that there's potential for asset price bubbles in Australia, in particular in the housing market? And what sort of macro-prudential policies have you considered or would be considering in terms of addressing that issue?
Okay, thank you. There's a lot there. I'm not going to duck the question, but I just want to start up by putting kind of this in a global context, because you know I think what's happening is we've got very low global interest rates. As I said, people in most countries are being offered zero on their savings in bank accounts, and they're looking for other assets, and that's pushing up the price of the existing assets, and that's how the transmission mechanism is supposed to work. And we've got some of that in Australia. I think the interest rates are low. They're not as low as they are elsewhere, but they are low, and they're encouraging people to buy other assets, and that's pushing up the price of those assets, and housing is the most obvious example of that. And in a sense, that's really what we wanted to happen. We wanted the higher housing prices to make it more attractive for people to undertake new construction, and by and large, that's happening. Residential building investment's up, I think, 8 or 9% last year, and it's going to be up almost again that much again next year. So that broadly is playing out as we expected and as we hoped. I mean, the problem in many other countries is that transmission mechanism from higher asset prices to higher real activity is not working. The issue that you highlight is whether that process is going too far. And that's always a difficult judgment to make. Our judgment so far has been that what's happened there is broadly okay. The issue we have focused on is the increased investor loans, and particularly the investor loans that are interest only. That a sense is that as a whole, those portfolios have become a little more risky, just because the ratio of house prices to incomes at the top end of the range that it's been. The momentum in the market has been strong. So we've highlighted that issue, and we said it's appropriate to look at whether, if you think this is more risky, whether there are some extra actions that could be taken. Probably just close with the observation, and I've made this before, and I think the Governor has made it as well, that the issues, the measures that are being discussed are not a return to very tight regulation that we saw in early decades, and it's not really the same as we're seeing in some other countries with high LVR, with caps on LVR loans. It's a more graduated approach that's similar to things that have been seen in the past. So it was a long-winded answer. But...
Oh, hi. Justin Faber from ANZ. It was good to see a speech on the long term, so it was good. I guess my question is more straying into political things. I know you don't want to do that, but so it's not an option. But I guess it's about market failure. You talked about the maths and science and generating an atmosphere for people to be entrepreneurs, which I think is important. I guess, do you think then were you hinting that there's market failure there and that there's a role for government to play? And I guess maybe putting it a different way, are you highlighting for our political leaders that maybe we've had 20 years of good time and the voters haven't pushed them yet to make some hard decisions around a various range of things, and do you think that time might come?
Mm. Well, obviously, I don't want to get drawn into any political debate here. The message that I think I'm trying to highlight is the need for us to take these culture issues seriously. And I don't think it's just a matter of the politicians to do that. It's collectively, as the leaders in the economics profession and as business leaders, to ask what it is, what we can do to promote that culture. It's not just in the area of government. And I suspect that you're probably right. More than 20 years of good progress has made us collectively, and this is not the government, it's business and labour as well, a little relaxed. And I think that process is now changing. The kind of the difficult conditions that many businesses have had over recent times is, and I hear this from talking to business people at the time, it's forcing them to go back and look at their management practices, their technology, their approach to the supply chain, and they're finding efficiencies. So I'm moderately optimistic that that process is working, but I do think as a society we do need to focus on what we can do, what individually we can do to promote a culture of risk-taking and of entrepreneurship, because I think both here and globally there's a real deficit of that spirit. And we're seeing kind of globally a deficit of aggregate demand, and that's having some of the spin-offs that I talked about. As deep down, I do not think that the rate of underlying technical progress in our societies has slowed down. So the underlying momentum, the underlying growth momentum, I don't think has fundamentally slowed down. I could be wrong on that, but that would be my judgment. And it's really kind of the entrepreneurial spirit, the drive to find new ideas and implement those ideas and to have the confidence to do that. I think that's the thing that's globally it's lacking. And collectively, I hope that we can work on a culture that then promotes that again. Because the alternative of just relying on ever looser monetary policy, it might ultimately work, but it does carry very large risks as well.
Bill Evans from Westpac. Phil, you referred to that insightful speech that you gave 2 years ago, and this one, of course, was also equally insightful. But in that speech, you did note that you thought that interest rates would continue to help the economy all the way down to 1%. I guess my question is, do you still believe that? Because we've heard a lot of talk about there's no point in cutting interest rates, it won't do any good. And the second part of the question along that theme was that in the Governor's speech earlier on in the week, he commented that cutting interest rates would just bring forward finite activity in housing, and then when rates had to rise would coincide with the time when the mining boom would be really turning down, so it would be quite counterproductive. Could you clarify that second point, and could you comment to me as to whether you still believe the 1% argument?
I can't quite recall saying 1%, but anyhow, I may have. I think what you're really asking is about the transmission mechanism and whether it's still working and how effective it's working. And in Australia, thankfully, that monetary transmission mechanism is still working. We are seeing lower interest rates lead to higher asset prices, and that's inducing more real activity in the economy. The problem that many other countries have is that mechanism is not working, or not at least not working very effectively. So my judgment would be that if further interest rates reductions were required, they would have some effect in stimulating economic activity. One of the issues that we talk about internally within the bank is the confidence effects of this is globally, but also has implications domestically, the confidence effects of yet further stimulatory monetary policy. That you reach at some, and I think this is why there's a limit, one of the reasons why there's a limit to the continuing benefits of stimulatory monetary policy, or even more stimulatory monetary policy, is you get to the point where the confidence effects don't seem to be as strong as they were in more normal times. I don't think we're there yet. So we're in a fortunate position that if we do need to lower interest rates, we can. And I think the other general point I'd make here is that stimulatory monetary policy largely works through what the economists we call intertemporal substitution. That is, bringing forward spending that we would have done tomorrow to bring it into today, and by doing that, hopefully we stimulate activity and make people feel better, and then the economy ends up doing better overall. But to do that type of intertemporal substitution requires people to borrow. And people globally, but it was, there's some element of this here as well, people don't want to borrow. They've had enough. And so the effectiveness of that part of the transmission mechanism, I think, is globally impaired. And it's reducing the effectiveness of interest rates and of low interest rates. And to some extent, I think that's an issue here as well. But overall, I think if we were to needed to lower interest rates, I think that would be stimulatory.
The point about housing, bringing housing forward, which would be counterproductive because there's a finite amount, and then when rates had to go up, that would coincide with an ongoing downturn in mining.
Well, that could happen, but you know, I don't feel like that's a major constraint. That's part of the transmission mechanism, the bringing forward of expenditure that would have occurred at some future point, bringing it to this period here, making the, and as a result, the economy stronger, and that helps lift sentiment, and we all are end up being better off. But they're clearly, you can bring too much of that forward, and then later on you pay a price for that. And so I think an issue, you know, how do you balance that? And ultimately, I suspect we are going to be better off if we have a prolonged period of elevated levels of housing construction, rather than trying to bring it all forward right to today and then have it collapse later on. And perhaps that was the point the Governor was making.
Thank you.
Yes, Michael Potter, I've got a question about two points that you've made in your speech. First of all, you said that you were aspiring to an economy which has got sustainably high purchasing power. And then later on, you reiterated a point that the bank has made several times, which is you'd like to see lower value of the dollar. So I'm wondering if you might be able to unpick the distinction between those two statements. Is the first statement about higher purchasing power, is that a longer term proposition, and lower dollar, is that a shorter term proposition?
Yeah.
And why would you like to, how would you see us transitioning from a lower dollar to, as you put it, higher purchasing power?
Yeah. Well, I think if we end up delivering on this aspiration, if we end up being this really high productivity, high value added economy, sustaining high real wages, then the purchasing power of our currency will be high, and that's something that a structural sign of success, just as high real wages are a structural sign of success and high returns on saving are a structural sign of success. But overlaid those set of structural considerations, as I said, the exchange rate plays a role in how the economy evolves at any point in time. And the real exchange rate in Australia is still quite high. And that largely reflects these positive fundamentals that I've talked about. So we do have a high exchange rate, and I would hope that over time our exchange rate, if we're successful, would stay high, higher than it had been, than certainly was in the 1990s. But that doesn't mean that any given point in time you want it to be higher than it is at that point in time, and we've made the point. And I think this has turned out to be reasonably accurate, that you know, 2 years ago we were saying that given our view about where the terms of trade were going, given our views about where investment was going, the exchange rate shouldn't be at $1.05. It should come down if it's going to play the stabilising role that it has. And We said that basically a year ago, the governor said this one thing was at 95. It should probably come down. And it has. So it's basically doing the type of thing, the stabilising role that that we would expect it to do, that we would hope it to do. It doesn't happen on the day that we would want it, or maybe the kind of the month or even the quarter that we think. But broadly, the exchange rate has continued to play the stabilising role. And as I said in my remarks, our assessment of the fundamentals is that it will continue on that trend. But I think it will still stay structurally higher than it was in the 1990s, and we should really hope for that, because that would be a sign that our economy was delivering on this aspiration of being highly productive and highly competitive globally at a high exchange rate, which is what we should hope for.
Brian.
Dr. Lowe, you mentioned there that there were downsides to having very low interest rates. The US has had virtually zero interest rates for 5 years. What are the downsides of having that for the US?
It's a very good question. I see the downsides more evident in other parts of the world, because in the US, I think you could argue that now this healing process is well advanced, and I'm relatively optimistic about how that's going to play out. That the higher asset prices there, it's the wealth effect on consumption, it's making people feel better again, and that process is kind of working its way through. There are some vulnerabilities that have been built up, but by and large, I don't think they're too worrying. It's in other parts of the world where the money you think about Japan, the JGB yield is for 10 years is 0.4, and the Bank of Japan's promising to deliver 2% inflation. So you're being promised a return of each year for the next 10 years of minus 1.6%. So that accumulates to a negative return, real return on a JGB of 20%, almost 20% over 10 years, and that's what the government's promising you. And so people are then trying, and you're starting to see this process now, people say, well, you know, is there an asset somewhere else around the world that will give me, over the next 10 years, a better return than minus 20? And people are starting to do that, and that pushes up the price of other assets, including in Japan. You've seen the effect on the stock market, and that can work if the underlying investment climate improves enough to ultimately validate that. But if the underlying investment climate doesn't improve to validate it, then all you've done is pushed up the asset prices to unsustainable levels, and ultimately there's a day of reckoning there. I think it's much harder to tell that story about the United States, and I will add here, Australia, than it is in some other parts of the world.
Dr. Lowe, John Peters from the CBA. I won't ask you about a cash rate question here, but just on the main theme of your talk about the building of Australia's capital and the broad human capital, broadening and deepening thereof, where would you put the full implementation of the Gonski report and the current ideas on tertiary changes in that context in terms of maximising the human capital in the future?
I feel in my remarks I've kind of tested the boundaries. I think you're asking me to go over the boundary there. I really just don't know enough about the particular reforms. I see it personally. I find it I think it's incredibly important that we do education well. You know, I grew up in a small country town, in a family with limited means, and I've seen in my own case the benefits of education, the way that it changes your views about the world. And I think as a society we need to do that well. Now, how we need to do it, or how we do it, how we fund it, how we set the incentives for teaching, how we do the incentives for research and collaboration, that's not my area of expertise. All I know is it's important, and I hope people in this room share that view, and I'm sure there are more experts here than me.
Rory can be lucky last.
Rory Robertson, Westpac Treasury. Dr. Lowe, thanks for a great talk. I too agree that the
the medium-term outlook for Australia is very bright. In fact, looking at your population chart, I wanted to rush out and buy another house. Massive outperformance in population growth.
Can I just interrupt? What you should want to do is go and build another house. Sorry.
Have you tried to renovate lately? My fearless forecast is that 2014 is going to be the first year in two decades that the Reserve Bank left the cash rate unchanged. Got 1 month to go, but fearless forecast. 1995 was the previous one. The bank gave a heads up in February that a period of stability was a likely scenario, and the banks delivered on that. Apparently, the consensus of economists today was that the economy is going to be sufficiently strong next year that you're going to break that period of stability and hike rates. I wonder, given the bank's outlook for growth, which is subpar growth, further rise in unemployment from 6.2%, what sort of unemployment rate do we need for the bank to decide that actually the outlook's not as bright as it needs to be and the economy can grow faster? Is it 6.5%? Is it 7%? Obviously, there's a range of indicators you look at, but the one that most people care most about is the unemployment rate. Do we need to get to 7% before the bank sort of wants to have a go at testing whether lower rates would be helpful for the economy?
Thank you. It's a good question. And we don't think about kind of critical thresholds under which we would or would not move interest rates. As I've probably talked about on previous occasions, that the framework we use is very much the flexible medium-term inflation targeting framework, and the interest rate decisions are taken in the context of that framework. So the question we're asking ourselves, is how fast is the economy likely to go and what's the inflation outcome likely to be? And In our recent set of forecasts, we're expecting inflation to stay around the middle of the inflation targeting band, and we're expecting the economy to grow a bit below trend for a while, but then to gradually pick up, and that's with the current setting of interest rates. And we would move away from that setting, or contemplate moving away from that setting, if we thought that the outcomes were going to be noticeably different from that. Either inflation was going to be too high or too low, and that's very much our anchoring framework. And so we don't have critical thresholds. We say if this variable gets above this variable at this level, then we're going to change. It's discussing how the outcomes are consistent with the medium-term inflation targeting framework.
Thank you.